Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And today, on the morning after the Golden Globes, we have one of the New York Times reporters who broke the original Harvey Weinstein story, along with other guests on the Me Too movement, moving into the Time's Up movement, very much referenced on the Globes broadcast last night. We also have President Obama's UN ambassador, Samantha Power, very special guest, and we'll meet the new speaker of the New York City Council, Corey Johnson. But first, the Golden Globes weren't just topical last night because of Me Too. Host for the evening, Seth Meyers, reminded everyone who the Golden Globes are presented by.
And we're all here tonight courtesy of the Hollywood Foreign Press. A string, yeah. Give it up for the Hollywood Foreign Press. A string of three words that could not have been better designed to infuriate our president. Hollywood Foreign Press. The only name that would make him angrier would be the Hillary Mexico Salad Association.
Of course, right now, Hollywood and foreigners are the least of Trump's worries, but the press is another story, as the new book by journalist Michael Wolff is sparking a new and heightened round of discussion about the president's basic fitness for office based on his ability to understand the complexities of his job and his basic mental state. Here is Wolff today on MSNBC's Morning Joe.
Everybody in this White House, and I keep saying this 100% because it is 100% of the people closest to the president, to Donald Trump, believe that there is something wrong here, something fundamentally wrong, something that scares them.
Michael Wolff on Morning Joe. And so here is another kind of Me Too moment. It's when Scarborough, who also has a Washington Post column, added this to Michael Wolff about what he, Scarborough, tried to put in print almost a year ago and wasn't allowed to.
There is such a reluctance, and I'm not certainly not knocking the Washington Post. They're actually being conservative with a small c. I've written twice in my column a quote about one of people closest to Donald Trump during the campaign saying he's got early stage of dementia. He repeats the same stories over and over again. His father had it, and it's getting worse, and not a single person who works for him doesn't know he has early signs of dementia. Now, of course, they didn't think he was going to win, but twice the Washington Post would not let me put that in my column, which, again, I salute them for having a high bar. But we are at this moment, and it's,
aren't we?
And until your book came out, this was something we're not allowed to speak about.
Joe Scarborough with co-host Mika Brzezinski chiming in there on their show, Morning Joe, on MSNBC today. Now, there is pushback to the Trump is mentally unfit narrative, at least publicly, from people in the White House currently, including CIA Director Mike Pompeo on Fox News Sunday after being asked about Wolf's statement by Chris Wallace.
Yeah, those statements are just absurd, Chris. I mean, just pure fantasy. My personal experience, I was with the president yesterday at Camp David. I'm with him almost every day. We talk about some of the most serious matters facing America and the world, complex issues. The president is engaged. He understands the complexity. He asks really difficult questions of our team at CIA so that we can provide him the information that he needs to make good informed policy decisions. And I've watched him do that. I've watched him take the information that the intelligence community delivers and translate that into policies that are of enormous benefit to America. Statements like the one Mr. Wolff made about how we all think about the president, they're just ridiculous on their face. They're frankly beneath the conversation this morning, Chris.
CIA Director Mike Pompeo with Chris Wallace on Fox News Sunday yesterday. So, with me now, Politico White House correspondent Annie Carney. One of her recent articles is Washington's growing obsession with the 25th Amendment. And, of course, that's the one that allows the cabinet to remove the president if he is deemed unfit to continue serving. Hi, Annie. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian. How are you?
Good. How much has the Michael Wolff book, Fire and Fury, brought 25th Amendment talk to a new level, or how much was this a rising obsession anyway?
I think it raised it to the forefront, but my article that you just cited, it talked about met lawmakers on Capitol Hill, mostly Democrats, inviting this Yale psychiatry professor, Bandy Lee, who has written a book called The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, to brief them on her findings about the president. And that happened, those briefings happened before the book came out in December. So it's been going on quietly behind closed doors. I think Michael Wolff's book has sort of busted it out. So Joe Scarborough's talking openly about dementia, which I think is dangerous and to make a clinical diagnosis when you haven't like that, but it's certainly brought it to the forefront, a conversation that's been going on for a while.
And listeners, your thoughts or questions for Annie Carney, Politico White House correspondent, on the contents of the Michael Wolff book and its ramifications, or anything on national policy, and we will get to some policy items too. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Or tweet at Brian Lehrer. Annie, you quote in your article a tweet from iconic conservative columnist William Kristol saying he trusts that Mike Pence has prepared a transfer of power draft document based on the 25th Amendment. How literal is William Kristol being with that tweet? And how much is he, as you know, a never Trump conservative from the beginning, just taking broad shots at the president?
I think it's the latter. The likelihood of Trump being removed from office by the 25th Amendment is very low. It's kind of a, I'm thinking about it as a broader way to address the president's fitness. But as you said, to use the 25th Amendment requires the majority of the cabinet and the vice president to vote to that he's not fit physically or mentally to occupy the office. Look at the photo op from Camp David over the weekend. It was Trump flanked by a large number of his cabinet members with the vice president standing next to him. There's no sign that they've lost confidence in him or that they would turn on him right now. So the question I looked at when I was writing the article is this just a fantasy of the hardcore never-Trumpers like Bill Kristol and liberal fantasists who want any reason to get rid of Donald Trump, or is there something more here? And I think there is something more here in that Democratic senators and congressmen and one Republican senator met with this psychiatrist to get a fuller understanding and picture of the dangerousness of Donald Trump and what his actions mean for the future of our country. And her findings are that he's unraveling under the pressure of the job, and it's going to get worse. And so I think that what's more interesting than will Mike Pence and the cabinet turn on Trump is what is the Hill thinking? Like, how seriously are they taking their concerns about his fitness for office?
And I see. Go ahead. What do you want to add?
One thing I wanted to add. Yeah, you played that clip of Pompeo defending the president.
Yeah.
You know, I've noticed this is a common theme that Trump surrogates do when he's under attack. During the campaign, when he was under attack for, accused by more than a dozen women of unwanted sexual advances and assaults, Ivanka came out to talk about her personal experience as his daughter, promoting her in the company, treating her as an equal with her brothers. This is Pompeo telling the American people, listen to me, based on my personal experience, he's great. There's no problem. They always turn to just pointing to their own personal experiences with him and telling the outside world, trust us. We know him better than you do. And I don't know how winning of an argument that is when the American people also have a lot of information about Donald Trump, from the tweets to the speeches, to make their own decisions about him.
Right. Although Pompeo, whether he's making it up or not, is arguing something that I think is generalizable if he's telling the truth, which is that he personally has these interactions with Trump, and they're on complex matters of intelligence and national security and foreign policy, and the president is able to digest it and integrate it and come up with leadership around it. So if he can do that with CIA stuff, then mm-hmm. presumably he can do that with all stuff.
Mm-hmm. And he's asking us to take his word for it, because
right.
he's seeing a side of Trump that the general public is not seeing.
Yeah. So what's the Washington Press Corps, you and your colleagues in the White House Press Corps in particular, take on the credibility of Michael Wolff's conclusions about the president. And to set this up, here's a clip of New York Times columnist David Brooks, for example, on Meet the Press yesterday.
A, he's got a lot of information that we didn't know, a lot of quotes from Steve Bannon that I think are totally credible. B, he doesn't normally meet the standards that most of us would meet at the New York Times or NBC or the Washington Post. There are just too many errors. So I think it's a valuable book, but one to be read with skepticism. I'm as anti-Trump as it's possible to be. And I think there are a lot of people I've spoken to who know Trump and who work with Trump who think exactly the way he says everybody thinks. But not everybody in this White House thinks that way. Some think he's deranged and a child. Some think something like him. Some think he's a problem they can work around. Some think he's strange, but in sort of a good way. So there's a lot more nuance here in the way the White House thinks about him than I think is reflected in this.
David Brooks, yesterday on Meet the Press, Annie Carney, White House correspondent for Politico. How much is David Brooks echoing a sentiment about Michael Wolff's journalism that is widespread among you who do this every day?
I think I agree with a lot of what he just said, especially in terms of Wolff's characterization that everyone in the White House thinks Trump is a madman and an idiot. That's just not true. It's much more nuanced, as Brooks just said in the clip you played. Overall, like, my impression from talking to sources and talking to my colleagues in the press corps is that overall the narrative is accurate. It gives you a rather accurate picture of what at least the first half of the first year was like in the Trump White House. It was chaotic. This Grand Central Station Oval Office, the fact that Wolff was there and like maybe people knew what he was doing and maybe they didn't is accurate, but there's a lot of flawed details, and it's just striking to me that the White House press corps has this sense that in this environment where Trump has made the press the opposition party and we are the enemy, you have to be bulletproof. There's no room for error because they will use it against you and weaponize it. And Michael does not seem to have that attitude. Like, there's been a lot of small factual errors pointed out. He has this scene at the Four Seasons where Ivanka Trump is having breakfast. He puts in that Washington Post national reporter Mark Berman was there. Mark Berman tweeted he's never been to the Four Seasons. It turned out it was a lobbyist named Mike Berman. These are little things that allow Trump to call it a fake book and allow you to question everything, which is what we try so hard to avoid day to day, because then everything we write will be under attack. So there's problems in the nitty-gritty of this book, but the overarching narrative paints a fairly accurate picture of what the first year was like.
Part of what David Brooks said in that quote was that the book does tell us a lot about Steve Bannon, and Bannon hasn't denied any of the quotes of him in the book, and apparently a lot of them Michael Wolff has on tape, so we don't have to read every Bannon quote with a skepticism that one might bring to Michael Wolff as you're describing it. Now, Bannon is trying to... Go ahead.
There's two different things in the book. There's stuff that Michael Wolff is asserting, and there's the on-the-record quotes. The on-the-record quotes, Bannon's not denying it. I talked to some people close to him yesterday who said he doesn't remember saying it, but Michael Wolff has threatened that maybe he has tapes, which is making everyone kind of skittish of, well, maybe I did say it and I don't remember. So no one's denying the on-the-record statements. Bannon has sort of expressed regret for them. But yes, the on-the-record stuff should be read separately from the stuff that Michael Wolff is just asserting.
So here is Salon's take on the most damaging thing that Bannon says in the book, and it's not that widely cited quote about Donald Trump Jr. Bannon is quoted saying about the Russia investigation, "You realize where this is going. This is all about money laundering. Mueller chose senior prosecutor Andrew Weissman first, and he is a money laundering guy. Their path to effing Trump goes right through Paul Manafort, Don Jr., and Jared Kushner. It's as plain as a hair on your face. It goes through Deutsche Bank and all the Kushner stuff. The Kushner stuff is greasy. They're going to go right through that. They're going to roll those guys up and say, play me or trade me." So what are your thoughts on that?
First of all, my thoughts on that are, like, it does sound, this is the way Bannon talks, and I have a feeling that what happened here is Michael Wolff was just around for so long, or that Bannon sort of lost track of what was on the record and off the record, because this is just Bannon rambling in the way that he talks to people. also hear this is a serious allegation and from a an innermost member of the Trump circle, but he's also someone who's Jared Kushner's nemesis and would love to see Jared's real estate business and go down in flames. So there's an agenda here. And if you notice in the apology he released yesterday, he was careful to walk back his statements about Don Jr., but he notably left out any walk back of what he said about Jared or Ivanka, who he sees as globalist enemies, and probably stands by all of those comments.
212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Eric in Long Island City, you're on WNYC with Politico White House correspondent Annie Carney. Hi, Eric.
Good morning, Annie. Good morning.
What you got, Eric?
I've got a question for you. What do you think the chances are that we could get 4 hours of televised interview with between Mueller and President Trump, and then we can judge for ourselves, much like Bill Clinton had? Maybe he'll have one of those Jack Nicholson meltdown moments in A Few Good Men. What do you think?
I don't think it would be Mueller interviewing the president on camera, which is what you said. We may get Mueller interviewing the president or Mueller's deputies interviewing the president, but it certainly wouldn't be on camera. Annie, what would you add?
Sorry, I missed the beginning of that question.
He just asked, what are the chances that the American people will get to see Robert Mueller grilling the president for 4 hours on camera like President Clinton was grilled in his special? Now, I don't think that Clinton was interviewed on camera either, not on camera, but zero. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'd say zero. Mueller, I've talked to people who think we might never hear Mueller's voice. He might, at the end of this investigation, he might release a statement internally. He's not a Comey type who wants to do a press conference and sort of grandstand a little bit. This is a behind-the-scenes operator who we might never hear from, period. So the idea of a televised back and forth, zero.
What Eric may have been referring to and may have gotten the quote from the book slightly wrong is that Michael Wolff wrote that Steve Bannon said that Mueller would interview Donald Trump Jr. On camera for 4 hours and crack him like an egg. You saw that quote, right?
Yeah, yes, the crack him like an egg quote. I don't think anything's going to happen on camera. And these interviews that are happening with Mueller's team, even, it's his lawyers who are conducting these day-long grilling sessions with aides. And he's often in the room. He's been described as kind of taking a fly-on-the-wall position, kind of standing in the back and listening, chiming in maybe occasionally. But he's not, when you hear about these aides going in to meet with Mueller's team, Mueller's not the one who is doing this 7 or 8 hour interrogation.
Right. And I guess if Donald Trump Jr. is to be interviewed and grilled on television and potentially crack like an egg under the withering questioning of anybody, it would be by members of Congress in one of those judiciary or intelligence or other committee hearings, which could be televised. And who knows if that might not be a major step on the way to collusion or obstruction of justice charges against the president. But that's probably how it would happen if it happens.
Yeah, agreed.
Jean in Jersey City, you're on WNYC. Thanks so much for calling, Jean.
Oh, thank you so much for the subject. I am someone who does not believe in calling anyone, including Trump, crazy, despite my own personal sentiment. And the reason I say that is because as a woman, how many times have women been told that they're crazy and dismissed because of that? If a woman's strong or independent, she's, you know, hung because she's a witch, or she's going through PMS, or she must be having hot flashes or something. And I do not believe calling anybody crazy is a way to accurately describe anything. And having been through it as a woman, I vehemently would not do it to anybody else.
I would say this, though, Jean, and I take your point, though. A lot of people are probably cringing at giving Trump a certain benefit of the doubt on the basis that women should be given more of a benefit of the doubt. But what the reporting is about people close to the president reportedly being genuinely concerned about his mental state. which is different than just a journalist or an armchair psychologist or something. Oh, that guy's crazy because he emotes so much or he says things that are out of the ordinary, whatever. There, if there's an actual line of reporting about people close to the president thinking that he may be mentally off in a way that could be damaging to the national interest, then that's worth reporting, isn't it?
Actually, I'm not quite sure about that, because who's to judge and who is to tell? There, just because an individual may not comport in the same manner as everyone else does not inherently mean they're crazy. So to me, I do find there's a large level of subjectiveness with that. And
you'd rather people just stay out of it?
No, I'm not saying stay out of it. I'm saying one may comment, but I do not believe that someone else's comments should render a decision about an individual. Because they're just comments, they're interpretations, they're also, okay, someone doesn't fly with the social norms, does that mean they're nuts?
Jean,
I'm not quite sure, only because I'm the black sheep of my family. They call me crazy.
I hear you. I get how you would identify with that. Jean, I really appreciate that input. Annie, how do you approach that as a White House correspondent? Because she raises legitimate concerns.
She has real concerns, and there is a psychiatric rule called the Goldwater Rule that doesn't allow mental health professionals to diagnose somebody if they haven't sat down one-on-one with the person to evaluate them. But what we can do and what people are doing is looking at his actions, his public actions, the tweets, his statements, and interpreting what these mean. So this is what this, again, back to the psychiatrist who briefed the lawmakers on the Hill, what she's doing is looking at public statements and assessing the president's level of dangerousness, is what she calls it. So she's looking at him going back to conspiracy theories and denying things like the Access Hollywood tape that he's admitted to before, tweeting violent anti-Muslim videos, the rush of tweets. This is behavior that we can interpret and say, and her conclusion is that he's falling apart under stress and he's becoming uncontainable. This is not a psychological evaluation, but this is looking at public behavior and drawing a conclusion from it, which I think is responsible.
And I see from your article that psychiatrist is going to continue to meet with members of Congress, including one of our locals, Rosa DeLauro from Connecticut, with a group in her home coming up in the next few weeks. So we'll see if anything comes of that.
Right. And to be clear, I'm not saying I agree or disagree with her findings, but I think this way of evaluating the president is legitimate versus calling him senile or suffering from dementia, when I agree with the caller that how can we say those things? We don't know.
How damaged do you think Bannon is politically in the way that might matter to the rest of the public, laying a slate of candidates out there for Congress this year to, you know, primary mainstream Republicans, so-called Mitch McConnell Republicans? Remember, Bannon was down there in Alabama personally campaigning for Roy Moore, and just weeks ago, the assumption was there is much more like that to come with Bannon, even though Moore lost, as the kingmaker of that wing in this year's midterm elections. How much is that? Because that's what really, who cares if Bannon personally is up or down? What really matters to the country is whether this Bannon white nationalist wing actually gets more candidates in there and primary their way into general election spots and then, populate Congress more.
That's exactly right. The bigger question out of this personal feud is, what does it mean for this fight for the soul of the Republican Party that's been going on between the populist wing represented by Bannon and the establishment wing represented by Mitch McConnell? And I talked to people last night for a story I wrote about this who said the timing for Bannon just couldn't be worse. This happened right after Trump had his first big legislative victory with McConnell and Ryan on tax reform at the end of last year. It happened so Trump was at his peak stage of anger while he was at Camp David all weekend with McConnell and Ryan. And that now we're already into 2018. Like, it's a little late for Bannon to be kind of building an infrastructure to fund these candidates. So what is he really... Oh, and he was dropped by Rebecca Mercer, his billionaire benefactor. So at this point, what does Bannon have to offer candidates that are running to establish Republican, establishment Republicans? Like, he can show up at a rally and bring with him what exactly? It's unclear right now. Some people were saying that the apology, quote-unquote apology over the weekend, was as much to mend fences with Trump as it was to mend fences with the base. So he still has some power from the people. But people think that he's pretty dead in the water right now in terms of playing a role in the midterms. One, I talked to a pollster who's pulled Bannon's name ID in Alabama and other states and said, like, pre-feud, he was seen as among Republican primary voters. It was 40% positive, 20% negative. And this pollster said he thinks it's going to flip and Bannon's going to be 20 positive, 40 negative or worse, and that he's just going to be zilch in the midterms.
Tina in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Tina.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. I was going to, similar to your previous caller, talking about his mental state and so on, and I wonder what are the roles, and thank you, your guest speaking to this Goldwater role that helps clarify some of it to me, but what are the responsibilities at Walter Reed for making certain that they have one-on-one conversation with Trump and that they do get that opportunity to diagnose? Is that a responsibility they have? Does he have privacy rights in their findings? All of the associated things. Every year we hear about presidents going to Walter Reed and having their checkups. And, you know, Reagan had a melanoma or something on his nose, you know. And so we hear about those things. But anyway, I'm trying to learn what our rights are about disclosure or follow-up with medical people when it's our country at stake.
What a great question. Privacy versus transparency to the public after the annual checkup at Walter Reed. Do you know?
I mean, it's a physical checkup. I don't think there's any mental part of it. I think that Sarah Sanders has said he'll do the checkup early this year. I don't know the answer to that question, but, you know, Ronald, you just mentioned Ronald Reagan had melanoma. He also had Alzheimer's that I think we only learned about after the fact. So I don't know the answer to your question, but I think the physical is just a physical, not a mental.
The Reagan parallel is interesting because Trump is actually using Reagan in defending himself the last few days. From the characterizations in the Michael Wolff book, Trump is saying, oh, remember Reagan? Everybody said he was losing it, and then it turned out he was fine. Well, I think it was actually the opposite. everybody thought he assumed he was fine, and then after he got out of the White House, the diagnosis uncovered the fact that he was gradually starting to lose it while he was still in office.
Right. Yeah, it wasn't a great parallel at this moment in time for Trump to tweet.
But there was the question of whether even there will be a mental health aspect of the evaluation that you raised. That's very interesting.
I haven't heard that there will be, but I don't know.
I guess maybe they don't routinely do that. And would they change in this case out of a certain sense of professional obligation under the circumstances at Walter Reed or not because it's not what they do and they don't want to get involved? That's a really interesting question, and we'll see. Let me get to a couple of policy items before we run out of time. The president announced over the weekend a request of Congress for $18 billion to build the wall between the U.S. and Mexico. So much for Mexico is going to pay for it, at least for now. But $18 billion is a lot of money. Is that a negotiation starter with the Democrats for a DACA deal?
I mean, it's really a non-starter. This is kind of the same list that the talks are going really badly. This is kind of back to where they were at the beginning with, like, there's no way the Democrats are going to agree with this. And they declared it on Friday a non-starter. Back in October when the White House said this, they said it was a non-starter. So the talks seem to be going badly. Both people have staked out positions that cannot be reconciled, and we'll see where it goes from there. It might just be a starting point for Trump to come down from, but it's not a good place to start.
And the deadline is a week from Friday for government spending authority to run out, so we will see how much of a government shutdown brinksmanship battle is starting over the immigration issue. And just tell us, because I'm going to ask every day if I get the opportunity until something is resolved, what's happening with CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program that covers so many millions of American children and technically ran out in December? Have they reauthorized it? Have they put in a meaningful patch in the meantime?
You know, I don't know. I'm sorry. I don't want to get it wrong.
Okay.
And I don't have been following the issue.
All right. And so one other thing on North Korea. Here is one more CIA Director Mike Pompeo moment of being totally in defense of the president as a very stable genius, quote unquote, yesterday on Fox News Sunday. Here he's asked by the host, Chris Wallace, about that Trump tweet at Kim Jong-un last week that got a lot of people afraid that Trump is daring North Korea to attack us with nuclear weapons. Wallace quotes the tweet.
Will someone from his depleted and food-starved regime please inform him that I too have a nuclear button, but it is a much bigger and more powerful one than his, and my button works. Question, how is that helpful to get in this back and forth of taunts with a leader whom you and the CIA judge as unstable?
This is the first time in an awfully long time that American policy has been consistent. That tweet is entirely consistent with what we're trying to communicate. We want the regime to understand that, unlike before, we are intent on resolving this, and it is our firm conviction that resolving this diplomatically is the correct answer, but that this administration is prepared to do what it takes to ensure that people in Los Angeles and Denver and New York aren't held at risk from Kim Jong-un having a nuclear weapon. That tweet is entirely consistent with that policy.
Annie, that was a full-throated defense of the my nuclear button is bigger than yours tweet.
It was basically saying the sentiment is accurate with American foreign policy. The way Trump expresses himself might be a little different, but there's nothing wrong with the content of what he said. That's what Pompeo is saying. Also, just so much happens so quickly these days that I forgot that it's not just Michael Wolff's book that has reanimated the conversation about mental health. It was actually this tweet that seemed extreme by Trump standards that got people thinking about that again. But if there's any question about the cabinet not standing behind him, there you go. I mean, there was no distancing in that statement from the president's extreme tweet.
So much for the 25th Amendment, at least for today. And by the way, folks, don't tell anybody, but I'm going to play that Mike Pompeo clip for President Obama's UN ambassador, Samantha Power, and compare their approaches to North Korea when Samantha Power is here next hour. For now, don't tell anyone. For now, we thank Annie Carney, White House correspondent for Politico. Thank you so much, Annie.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we will meet the brand new New York City Council Speaker. After Melissa Mark Viverito comes Corey Johnson. He's here in our studio. Stay tuned.